everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon into understandable everyday terms for regular folks. Our goal is to build understanding about the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today, we're going to talk about a looming crisis in our criminal justice system. That's the growing lack of public defenders to handle cases for indigent defendants. This has been a looming crisis since about 2016, but it's really become a critical problem over the past few years all across the country. So let's start off with talking just a little bit of law here before we get more into the problem. And that is, back in 1963, I know that seems like forever ago, there was a case called Gideon versus Wainwright. And we won't get into all the details of the case. It was a U.S. Supreme Court case. And as part of the Earl Warren Court, when he was Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, they came out with a lot of things to help criminal defendants. And this case provided that there was a constitutional right, a Sixth Amendment constitutional right, for indigents — that means people who don't make a lot of money and are at a poverty level — to have legal counsel in criminal cases where they have the possibility of incarceration. So that was in 1963. Courts started adapting how to do that. We had all kinds of public defender state systems, local systems crop up all across the country. But today, 90%, according to recent studies, 90% of criminal defendants qualify for a public defender. The system is stretched, and there are fewer public defenders to meet an ever-increasing need for them. This is causing a major problem, Judge Gail.
Absolutely. And Tom, I'd like to begin by making just a small point of clarification for our listeners.
Sure.
When we talk about public defenders, these are attorneys that come to assist or work or help with indigent or poor defendants in one of two ways. In just about every community in every state, there is an actual office that is funded by the state legislature or by the Supreme Court that is known as the Public Defender's Office. And those attorneys work specifically for that office to do the work of defending indigent defendants. However, in many of these same communities across the country, there are also independent or private attorneys who do not work in a public defender's office, but perhaps have their own private defense practice. And they can also be assigned or offered the opportunity to take on cases to defend indigent defendants when they cannot afford their own attorneys. Again, these attorneys go by different terms. They could be assigned counsel or
appointed counsel.
But they serve the same purpose as a public defender, except that they do not work specifically inside of a public defender's office. Often, it is imperative and it's ethical and it's required that a public defender's office not accept a case for a certain defendant, perhaps if there are multiple defendants in a case, if they have represented someone who has a certain relationship to a defendant that would cause them to have an ethical conflict. So it's necessary to have these appointed counsels or these attorneys that will do this work to shield the public defenders from ethical conflict, but also to still provide that much needed attorney client assistance that you only find in that relationship. So I want listeners to be very clear to understand that it doesn't mean that because you're a public defender that you are less capable, less able, that you do not know or cannot navigate the law like attorneys that you would retain or pay for. Often, sometimes those same attorneys that are paid for or retained also take indigent cases, or they are assigned counsel in other cases. So they can do the work in both ways.
In fact, public defenders, one commentary that I read recently called them the pack mules of the system. And that's not a slight. That just means that they carry the biggest load of the criminal justice system. The numbers that some of these public defenders, their caseloads are just astronomical. Harvard Law Review back in 2013, let me pull out a quote here. Harvard Law Review 2013 said, legal scholars have repeatedly described this as a national crisis. Just over the last decade, the Sixth Amendment Center, a nonprofit organization that evaluates indigent defense systems, has published reports documenting how the constitutional right to counsel in our criminal courts is routinely violated in Delaware, Illinois, Indiana, Maine, Mississippi, Nevada, Oregon, Utah, and Wisconsin. And during the same period, the American Bar Association developed evidence-based state-specific workload standards for public defenders in Colorado, Indiana, Missouri, Louisiana, Rhode Island, and in January of 2024, New Mexico and Oregon, which require most offices to be double their current size to meet the workload. Now, my reading of that is to show that this is not a one-state problem. This is a national crisis.
This is absolutely a national crisis. And I don't know that there are too many judges that have not seen this crisis face forward. What you just outlined by identifying all of those states and all of those jurisdictions who we know now are struggling, not to say the least for those who have not been identified in that list, because I would go as far as to say, I am struggling to understand why Ohio's not on that list.
Right.
Because I have seen myself how that shortage has impacted caseloads. For example, you know, and it has to be understood that in some jurisdictions, actually funding and financing the offices of public defenders or even appointed counsel is different. That formula is different. In the community that where I sat on the bench, I deeply held and believed and was committed to the tenets of Gideon versus Wainwright. I still, to this very day, Judge, I believe that if the court even has the ability, if the law gives the court the legal authority, whether it's mandatory or not, if you have the legal authority to ever impose a term of incarceration, meaning if someone is ever facing even the threat or potentiality of losing their freedom for even a day, that they are entitled to counsel under Gideon versus Wainwright, that is a basic civil right. And in our world of jurisprudence as judges, we should be doing everything we can to help ensure that that right is protected. Now, again, in my view, I know that there are judges that believe that low-level offenses that don't seem all that serious don't really deserve appointed counsel. But you never know. And how many times have you had a case where something seems like it's pretty straightforward? You can almost guess from, you know, arraignment how you're likely going to rule and resolve this case. And then somewhere in the middle, things go sideways. And you learn something new or something else happens and it causes you to reconsider how you might approach this at the point of finality. Again, if that means that you will ever even consider taking someone's freedom, they deserve the right to counsel from the very beginning. And I, quite frankly, I don't care if that is a speeding ticket or if that is a domestic violence charge. If you are facing that as a potentiality, I need for you as a defendant to tell me that you are waiving or giving up your right to counsel, because in my view, that is a right that I am duty bound to protect and to guard because the Constitution says so. And so many jurisdictions, including the one that I was sitting in, fail to adequately fund courts and public defender's offices so that that right can be protected, which I think serves to exacerbate the problem.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Excuse me. There are different kinds of systems in different states, and you need to, as an audience member, you need to look at your own state. However, a lot of them have state-funded public defenders that serve the state across the state, the public defenders hired to represent people in a certain geographical area. Other states, that is a local expense, not a state expense. So there are variations. One common practice, though, is that the state will provide public defenders. But as Judge Gale mentioned earlier, let's say you have a case where there are three defendants. Well, the public defender's office can only take one. You can't represent three people on the same charge. So that means the court has to find two private attorneys to take the other two cases. Funding for that usually is local, which means it is either the local city or the local county or the equivalent of a city or county that has to cough up that kind of money. That's where the bind comes in. It's not just the public defender's office. It's funding from the top clear down to that appointed counsel level that's in jeopardy.
You're absolutely right. And that's often where the rub is, if you will, that whether or not those jurisdictions, whether it's a county or if it's a city, either find value in providing that funding, because I think in some instances, just fundamentally, this is an issue about whether or not the funding authorities really respect and appreciate the work that is done in order to ensure that a fair justice system exists for all.
Well, finding the attorneys to do it.
And because finding the attorneys.
The funding authorities are so damn cheap, you know, that they set either a firm limit on a type of case, a misdemeanor of a certain level, you get $500 as an attorney, which is probably maybe one-third, one-quarter of the normal rate that attorney gets.
And depending on how complex it is, if you break it down by hourly, you may be making less than minimum wage.
Absolutely. And so it's finding the attorneys who are willing to do it for a cut-rate price. And Indeed. As a result, I'll tell you, I was on the bench. I was sitting last year and finding private attorneys that were willing to do cases for the kind of pay that they were getting was a real problem.
Indeed. And I think, and this may be maniacal thinking, Judge, but I think maybe that's a problem that's in some regards purposely created. Because if it means that you can't find attorneys that are willing to do it at this cut rate, which sometimes you start looking to, you know, newly graduated or newly licensed attorneys that are just trying to get experience. So they'll, you know, they're willing to do it at this huge discount in order to get that experience. But I think in some instances, the goal is to see, you know, how much the system can be ground down before the argument can be made that, you know what, we don't really need it after all. Why is it a line item in the budget? Because nobody's getting private attorneys or nobody's getting appointed counsel anyways. And that really, I think, puts judges in a particular bind, because when it was my experience, I increased the line item for assigned counsel for this very reason. Because again, I could never predict how a case was going to end, no matter how it began. I could never predict how it would end. But I always knew that no matter what, the defendant was owed a right to counsel. Now, they could always reject it. They could always decline. I had defendants who would start out with a job and an attorney that they hired or they could retain. And somewhere during the life of the case, maybe they lose employment or something catastrophic happens and they can't pay for that attorney anymore. Their case is still going on. So it doesn't mean that they deserve any less representation. But if you have a counterpart in government that does not appreciate the value of being represented and well represented by counsel that, just like you said, is not overburdened, not overloaded, not the pack mule of the system, but actually has the time to devote to the case. Because I promise you, there's nothing more frustrating to a judge than to have an attorney that's unprepared.
Oh, and absolutely.
You come in there and you waste my time. You filed motions that you hardly know what's in them. You've asked for hearings and you're not prepared. You haven't done the research. You haven't talked to your client. You don't know, you know, what offers may or may not exist to resolve the case. That is, for me, now that talk about triggers, that is triggering and infuriating, because it tells me you don't respect anyone. You don't respect your client. You don't respect the court. You don't respect anything. But again, if you're also asking someone to do this with an overwhelming caseload, that where they're also being compensated at a fraction of what they might otherwise make, then what you've now created, and I hope that we have listeners that are in other branches of government that understand this and are better able to understand this because of this discussion, but what you have done by not partnering with the court meaningfully in that regard is you have just created a system of disenfranchisement for defendants. And that it is a system where we have promised justice and we have promised equality under the law, and we are failing to deliver over and over again because our partners, our justice system partners that do include other members and other branches of government, do not fully appreciate our requirement to be committed to this important tenet.
It's a constitutional right.
It is.
It's a constitutional right.
Mm-hmm. And I see some just think it's a suggestion. I'll tell you, I dealt with the jurisdiction that really saw it more as a suggestion than an absolute right that is enshrined in the Constitution. And that's very challenging, especially, again, when we go back to the topic of trying to imbue faith in the system. We want people to trust us and we want people to trust the system. And yet there are those who purposely or maybe not purposely, they're just so unappreciative of its importance that they've created a system that hamstrings the court's ability to actually deliver justice. That should be shocking to anyone.
Let me give our listeners just some statistics that I came up with in preparing to talk about this. In Pennsylvania, in May of 2024, that's just a couple of months ago, They did a study, the University of Pennsylvania Law School did a study and found that 1,200 public defenders were needed to service the client base in the state of Pennsylvania, 1,200. Currently, they have 850.
That's
a 30% shortfall.
Yikes.
On the number of public defenders needed. They went on to say that 60 of 66 counties have attorney staffing levels below what is required. I went on to Missouri. Missouri did a statewide study and found that the public defenders they have, because they have fewer than what are needed, their caseload is 225% above recommended levels. 225%
above
recommended levels.
Yikes.
Now, you look at the state of Washington. They're in crisis, as many states are. But I in one of the articles I read about the state of Washington, I think our listeners can relate to this. They say the shortage in public defenders is just like the shortage of ER nurses during the COVID epidemic. So remember, we didn't have enough nurses or medical people to handle the volume. Well, this is the same thing, except in the judicial system.
Isn't that shocking?
In the state of Washington. Now, what really comes to fore is, this is true in all states, is that the rural areas are hit harder than the urban areas. In other words, it's harder to get people in rural areas to take cases or to have a full-time public defender. Let me give you Ohio as an example. Now, Ohio is a state that has 88 counties. A recent study came out and said while 75% of Ohio lawyers practice in the state's seven biggest counties, seven out of 88, many of the rural areas lack access to high-quality legal services. By the same token, a little more than half of Ohio's population live in smaller counties in need of public defenders or court-appointed counsel. Yeah, those are just some statistics, Judge, that show the true gravity of the situation.
It's shocking.
It is, and I think what I would like for us to talk about next is what impact this has. Now, one thing is that in all of these studies that they've looked at, what we're finding are clients or defendants are languishing in jail longer than they should be because they have lack of representation.
Absolutely.
That's one ramification of this. Do you see that?
Oh, absolutely. And it also should be expected, right? When you don't have an attorney to help them understand and navigate their charges or the situation, then and they have allegedly or they've been accused of committing a serious offense, then yes, they're going to sit in jail longer than they should without the benefits of counsel. Now, that also cuts the other way because even though they're sitting in jail and whether they have the benefit of counsel or not, it does not mean that the system thereby gets additional time to prosecute the case. You still have to prosecute the case within a certain period of time, which is called speedy trial. And that's a whole nother episode that we touched on previously, and we will revisit again another day.
On that one. That's right.
But it doesn't change that clock. But what it does do is not only does it, again, back to that issue of disenfranchisement, right? So not only are we violating the rights of the defendant, of the accused, and we're disenfranchising them by not providing them access to ready access to counsel, which again is a coveted right enshrined in the Constitution, we're also disappointing and letting down victims who are also relying on this system to work as well at the same time. So it's not just the defendants that are impacted, it is the victim, and then by extension, entire communities are impacted.
So we have a higher jail population because people are being held without bond or with high bond and not hearing arguments on bond. Then also, you know, by and large, I have to say that the quality of public defenders that I've come across is exceptional. These are people that deal with high volume situations and deal with them very well. They have a great way of being able to separate the wheat from the chaff, so to speak, on what cases should go forward with actual trials, what cases can be pled out. They do a great job. But as a judge, I am unnerved when I see a person who is in front of me on a case meet their attorney for the first time in the courtroom, and the attorney asks for a recess so they can go out in the hall and discuss the case. You know, and that happens over and over and over again because they have not the time. And their caseloads are so extraordinary, they do not have the time to process every case before they come to court.
And so if I can say, Judge, this goes back to that concept of access to justice. And this speaks actually to one of the four tenets of access to justice, which is the right to competent and well-resourced counsel. It is not enough to merely put a warm body, or as one of the judges I used to prosecute in front of, she would call them potted plants. It is not enough to put a potted plant in the courtroom next to a defendant and say, yep, I met the burden. There it is. There you have someone. But the attorney needs to be competent, and they need to be well-resourced. Now, what does competency mean? Competency means that they are adept in the law, but they actually know the subject matter. Yes, you may have new graduates from law school that are just practicing and they're kind of finding their footing. And so competence, there are different levels of competency. Obviously, and hopefully any judge worth their weight would never assign a newly minted attorney to an ag murder case or a capital murder case. Something like that is just irresponsible, and it invites an appeal on ineffective assistance of counsel. But you can have competent counsel, but you can have counsel that knows the law very, very well. But as you said, they're so overburdened and they're so overloaded that they don't meet their client until they show up in court. Yeah. And that speaks to the issue of resources and whether or not they're well-resourced. Well-resourced covers a lot of ground. It means, you know, do they have the support systems in place to manage the caseloads that they have? If you are constantly assigning cases either to the public defender's office or to certain attorneys who are being assigned as counsel, do they have the resources that are necessary so that they can spend enough time with the defendant before they come to court, before they come to the hearing, so that they can do the adequate background research on the case and provide a viable defense? if a defendant has an alibi, but their attorney is too overwhelmed with their caseload to even look into the alibi or to ever search down or seek out interviews with important parties, that is, you might as well not have an attorney, because that does not provide someone with the constitutional rights protected under Gideon that are pronounced in Gideon versus Wainwright. All you've done is given them somebody with a pulse.
But I see public defenders doing much better job, full-time public defenders doing a much better job at that than court-appointed counsel. Court-appointed counsel, because they're getting paid a fraction of what their hourly rate is, cut corners all the time. And especially now that most courts allow virtual court proceedings. You know, I was sitting there with a client, a defendant on Zoom, the attorney, court-appointed attorney on Zoom, prosecutor live in the courtroom. The attorney had never met in person the defendant. We'd have to allow them to go into a conference chat.
A breakout room. Yeah.
And then come back in. You know, they don't even see the client, the court-appointed counsel sometimes, whereas at least the public defenders are in the courtroom and they have a face-to-face with somebody. That just struck me as really horrible. And then some of them, court-appointed counsel would cut things like, In Ohio, you have to file a jury demand on a misdemeanor case. A jury trial is not automatic. If you don't file it within a certain period of time, then you've given up that right. You've waived your right to a jury trial. You know, I had one court-appointed attorney who would never file jury demands, no matter how serious the case was, because it was an extra step and would cost him more hourly time to do that. You know, that shortchanges the whole system. So not only do we have people in jail, but we have people who are actually in the courtroom or there virtually who are not getting represented.
And not to mention if that jury trial actually goes forward, right? So if you have that same attorney thinking about, oh my gosh, just an extra step just to file the jury demand, if they have a defendant who insists on a jury trial that's actually going to go forward, then that means that that's more time that it takes to prepare, is more time that it takes to deliver in that jury trial. And mind you, the rate for their services does not increase because there's a jury trial.
So they'll talk their client into taking a deal.
Indeed.
They'll use every technique possible to get that client to plead to something or to take a deal to avoid a trial.
And that's, again, another, I think, downfall of kind of this emergency that has to some degree been manufactured. Because, and tell me what you think. I genuinely believe that there are some huge parts of this that might very well be resolved if there were proper funding for public defender's office and for assigned counsel. And I know that we can't throw money at every problem, but I think that we are still graduating some exceptionally sharp and hungry lawyers that would be willing to do this kind of work if, in fact, the right levels of compensation existed, and that it becomes a deterrent to do this if there's more of a loss than there is a gain, especially financially. If you've just come out of law school and you're six figures in debt because of student loans, and now you aren't even truly compensated for the work that you do, then that, I think, makes the problem bigger. But tell me what your thoughts are, Judge. I believe we could probably resolve this with, again, some better financial resources, but I could also be jaded in looking at this
one. No, I think better financial resources and everybody stepping up to the plate, even if the state legislatures are not willing to put up more money for a statewide public defender system, which they should, It's imperative, and it's a, as we've said many times, it's a constitutional right that has to be enforced by the courts. You know, then you get local groups, local government officials that have to step up. They have to understand that this is not something that is an extra. This is not something that is icing on the cake. It is a foundation of our judicial system and has to be supported. It must be supported, but it's not, and it's causing major issues.
Indeed.
It is funding. It's funding based. And one next step I want to take, Judge, and that is we haven't talked about why there is this shortage. And one of the reasons is financing and funding and lack thereof from state groups. But there's also a factor of public defenders leaving being public defenders. You know, it used to be that you'd go into a prosecutor's office or a public defender's office, you'd work for several years, and then you'd go on to private practice or move on to some other area. But these people, one, the wages are so low, they're below standard. Two, they're overworked. You know, what did I say, 225% of a normal caseload? Now, so there's a major burnout factor, and there's also the situation that the young people now come out of law school with massive six-figure debt.
That's exactly the point I was saying, is if you come out with burdening, crushing debt, this becomes public service in general, just becomes unappealing. And when you mentioned kind of the matriculation of many public defenders or prosecutors throughout their career, it reminds me of an old colleague who I met while a prosecutor, and he was an extraordinary prosecutor. And he actually, I remember this was a few years ago, we had lunch and he had left the prosecutor's office to go into private practice. Actually, no, he joined a large firm. And he started doing white collar defense in a large firm. And his response was, hey, I'm married. And, you know, at some point I had to have a conversation with my wife and I just couldn't keep playing cops and robbers. And I had to go actually make money to take care of my children. And public service is, I think, honorable work, but we also have to make it the kind of work that is attractive for good talent, like my colleague who ultimately left public service because in order to take care of himself and his family, it's just not something that's practical. We're not talking lucrative. We're just talking practical. And
living wage. And living wage.
A living wage. And these are things, these are real life considerations that lawyers, young lawyers are making. I think one thing we could do, which is something I did in my court when I was on the bench, is create partnerships between courts and law schools. You have many young law students that have internship opportunities or other opportunities, either work study or otherwise, where they could actually work in the role of supporting public defenders and prosecutors' offices while getting some practical training even prior to graduation that could really help relieve pressure on the system.
Contacting, basically acting as an paralegal in many respects, of contacting the client, making sure the client knows when the court date is, making sure that there's some contact before the court date, all of those things. Yeah, you're right, because not only is the public defender overworked, the current public defender staffs are overworked.
Indeed. So it speaks to that issue of being well-resourced and creating resources where we may not have otherwise realized or acknowledged that there's an opportunity and quite clearly a void to be filled. There came a time, again, during my time on the bench where, you know, the jurisdiction, the city just didn't have the best respect or appreciation for the necessity to properly prosecute cases. So I actually went and reached out to the local law school, one of the law schools, and they created this program with me.
Well, that's the kind of innovation that we have to look to, I think, solve this problem. You know, some states have tried different things. I want to get your reaction to this. Texas has started giving vouchers to defendants, indigent defendants, giving vouchers to indigent defendants and say, go find your own lawyer.
Oh my gosh.
So what do you think, like, of that as it relates to Gideon versus Wainwright and the constitutional right to counsel?
Well, and that's, oh my goodness. So it also goes to that issue of competency, right? If you give an indigent defendant a voucher to, you know, essentially put in a shopping cart and go out there and shop around for their own attorney, how do they know? I mean, but for, I guess, the attorney's declarations, how do they know that they are competent? How do they know that they are resourced enough, well-resourced enough to provide the kind of assistance that they need for their case type? And what happens if you have an attorney that ultimately asks the court for removal? Do you provide them another voucher? Do you have a limit on the number of vouchers one gets? I just can imagine, you know, all kinds of challenges. Although, here's what I will say, because it's really easy to take a program like this and start picking it apart and immediately looking for the downside. I would have to say, although this was pretty shocking, I kind of celebrate Texas for its innovative approach to what is a stressful system that is in place, that they are at least trying to find solutions that may be unorthodox, right? They may
and
be
in rural,
unusual
rural areas that might work.
Exactly. Know? Now, you might have the local probate lawyer now doing, you know, criminal defense. They're boning local, up on their criminal defense, but if it keeps
local the, real estate attorney.
Exactly. The real estate attorney is now doing, you know, minor traffic offenses, but it certainly, what it does, I think also, because sometimes I think people misunderstand that when you go to law school, the law is so vast that no one person knows and has mastered every aspect no. of the law. Not one person. That's why there is called a practice. And that's why there are certain disciplines within the law itself. And so I think under this system, it would certainly invite a lot of cross-discipline training for lawyers, especially in rural areas where lawyers are very, very difficult to find. And you still have issues and crimes that need to be addressed, and they need to be addressed timely. It actually will encourage, I think, some of those lawyers to to learn a new trick and to hang out a new shingle or bluff up a shingle.
I'm chuckling because I was just thinking of the lawyer ads that could come out of
Listen.
This. You know, we see ads in medical situations, except Medicare or Medicaid. We see ads, you know, except food stamps or the equivalent of food stamps at grocery stores and so forth. Could you see a lawyer ad? You know, except vouchers. You know,
right? Accepts vouchers, right? Yeah. Or the sign. Or imagine going to the local bakery and you're like, you know, next to muffins, you got wheels, trusts, and speeding tickets. this is the menu board now. And bring your voucher. We'll accept vouchers here.
Well, Ohio has come up with a unique plan, and I want to get your feedback on this. In fact, I interviewed for another podcast, a Spectrum podcast that I've done. I interviewed Chief Justice Sharon Kennedy of the Ohio Supreme Court on this. She's come out and said every Ohioan should have access to justice. And so they've come up with a program where lawyers who work as state public defenders, now get this, lawyers who work as state public defenders, county prosecuting attorneys, for a county public defender commission or a joint county public defender commission, have been licensed for 8 years or less can earn the student loan, can earn student loan forgiveness. They must also represent low-income clients in what the state defines as an underserved community. In other words, if you're a public defender, you can get $10,000 loan forgiveness for 3 years. So a total of $30,000 student debt loan forgiveness if you become a public defender. What do you think of that?
I think they can do better. If you leave law school with six figures of debt, and it takes you, 3 years to get $30,000 shaved off of that, you'd have to work a long time to get all of your loans forgiven. Presumably, if in fact they continue to forgive those loans year over year at that same rate, if it caps at $30,000, again, you are presumably going to have young lawyers that are, you know, going to still be looking at a considerable amount of student debt even after 3 years. And at the same time, I don't know that I heard anything about living wage or wage increases, because although it may be enticing to have some portion of student debts forgiven, the fact of the matter is that anyone is going to tell you, I still have to pay the rent or the mortgage now. I have to buy food for my family now. I work because I need to take care of my family now. And quite frankly, if I went through all of this work to earn a law degree, I expect that degree to go to work for me.
Well, there's a second part of this. I told about people who are public defenders, county prosecuting attorneys, and so forth. Additionally, attorneys might qualify if they work as counsel appointed by the court or chosen by a low-income client, as long as they work in that underserved community for at least 520 hours a year. Students in their last year of law school and those who were admitted to practice in Ohio for less than 8 years are eligible. So that goes to the court-appointed counsel. If you do up to 520 hours a year as a court-appointed counsel, but not a full-time public defender, mm-hmm. you can also get the loan forgiveness.
Now that, again, I mean, especially if you are in a environment that supports that type of work, then I think that certainly makes it worthwhile. Another thing I think is worth considering, even for criminal cases, because I see it a lot more where it has worked and has been effective, it's been more so a focus on civil cases, are creating criminal self-help centers. I think there can be broad agreement that some criminal cases, especially low-level nonviolent offenses, where the defendant still would benefit from having assistance and shepherding through the process, might actually help to relieve some of the pressure on public defenders by creating self-help centers that provide them either one or two times free of charge an ability to be screened by and to speak with an attorney just about generally the nature of their case. And because we know for many of these low-level nonviolent offenses, the defendants are pro se, meaning they are self-represented, it, I think, also helps the court to have self-represented litigants who actually know something about the system and the process. And so if they can go to a self-help center and they can be counseled by an attorney free of charge, they can have their case assessed free of charge. They can maybe get assistance with preliminary motions free of charge. That could help as well.
But who's going to pay for that? Who's going to set up the self-help system?
Well, I know in
Ohio, local government, the state, who's going to do that?
Now, I genuinely believe that there is a benefit to having all of these stakeholders come together and to assist with funding so that the complete financial responsibility does not fall to one or the other. So you have if you can have state level assistance that is coupled with perhaps county and then local assistance, especially in rural areas. Imagine how this could assist a rural community if you had, you know, if you were able to take over, you know, an old storefront, and that storefront is maybe it is run regularly by a paralegal or some kind of assistant, but you have attorneys in the area that sign up to volunteer to help assess and to review cases, you know, several times a week. So maybe it's 3 to 4 times a week, but they're rotating.
That's part of a bar association activity.
Exactly.
Or an attorney's duty to give pro bono work, which
precisely
means for free.
Exactly. Yeah. And what if at the same time you could get all of the local courts to agree on standardized forms for certain basic things? So if you walk into the self-help center and there's a standardized form for continuance, or a standardized form to demand a jury, or a standardized form for for a certain type of hearing, maybe it's a suppression hearing or something. Well, if all of the courts agree that we'll all accept this form because it's coming from this kind of centralized self-help center where, again, low-level nonviolent offenders are able to go, the Bar Association partners with the state, the county, and the local government to help give these individuals some assistance in getting through the legal system, I think, again, it can go a long way, especially in relieving the pressure at the base level, right? Usually at those municipal courts where they have the highest volume, the most amount of cases, where defendants often tend to be self-represented, but they don't know how to represent themselves. This could be something that cures it. And if you offer to the attorneys on the back end, either the loan forgiveness or, you know, some kind of recognition for the hours that they volunteer or that they give up, it could really be a win-win-win, I believe, or beneficial all the way around, especially if you can get the financial support.
That I think is a great idea.
I just came up with that.
I think you should send that off to the powers that be. One last thing that I wanted to talk about, this might sound facetious, but it's not intended to be. We're having a national crisis. We've gone through clear across the country. I read a litany of states that are not meeting even minimum requirements. You know, I don't trust the Supreme Court of the United States right now. And
really?
I'm waiting for someone to say, well, we can solve this crisis by just having the court reverse Gideon versus Wainwright.
And I was just thinking that in this very moment and saying, you know, I think if it were this Supreme Court, you could almost count on them doing the unthinkable, right? A right that is enshrined in the Constitution, paring it down and limiting it so that there are only certain individuals that now have the right to counsel.
Maybe just felony cases,
right,
or maybe right, just death penalty cases,
yeah,
or
right,
life imprisonment cases.
Correct.
There could be all kinds of machinations with this.
Now, and granted, in some regards, you have, you know, some communities, some jurisdictions, as you said, this is very pervasive in rural areas. There are some places where it's effectively happening already. You know, the belief, especially for lower level courts, is that they're no more than money makers or ATM machines anyway. So, you know, why would we ever bother funding counsel for people who we want to shake down for money anyways? That barely gets us to the break even point. Let's
some public
save the money.
Are actually financed by fines.
Yes. Yes.
The country.
Yes. It is, and that presents its own challenges. But, you know, imagine some bean counter on the other side saying, well, why don't we save the money and not provide the public defenders, not provide the assigned counsel, and still lean on the courts to impose fines that are sometimes, you know, oppressive and just unattainable, but have the court still impose the fines with the threat of jail, and people will pay, they'll raise the money. And not only will we save on not giving the appointed counsel and protecting a constitutional right will actually make money by imposing impossible fines and forcing people to pay under the fear or threat of imprisonment, because debtors' prisons, whether we call it that or something else, the idea of it is still in play in many, many places, and folks are still abiding by it. I mean, heck, and it's not just the South. Again, come on up to Northeast Ohio, and I'm willing to bet donuts to dollars that the court that I once sat on is still doing that same thing, because that's how they saw courts anyways. They didn't see it as it being this being a right, a constitutional right that is protected. They saw it as this is an expense that we can save on. We can zero out this line item and we can still lean on the court to shake people down for money, and we'll be all the better for it. So I think you're absolutely right, Tom, that we certainly have I think there's a lot of work to be done.
Well, the Supreme Court reversing so many precedential cases gives me pause. And I am, as a judge, retired judge, and a former defense attorney, I sure as hope they stay the hell away from criminal defendants' rights, because I could see within the next few years a major, major cutback of these things and say, hey, we solved the problem. Yep. We fixed said it. There was a right back in 1963, but guess what? No right.
Yeah, it's all fixed now. And you make a really important point as a retired judge and former defense attorney, and even me as a retired judge and former prosecutor, I am equally concerned. First of all, the system doesn't work well where there's not, you know, good balance on both sides of the room. And you need the balance of the defense. Everyone is entitled to a defense, no matter what you've been accused
of.
Right. It actually makes for better prosecutors. It forces prosecutors to bring only the best cases that have been well investigated and are prepared.
Evaluate their cases.
Exactly.
Evaluate those.
It doesn't allow them to rest on their laurels and to essentially run roughshod over the people they're supposed to protect. At the same time, we, as I said before, we absolutely need it, because prosecutors are accountable to communities and specifically to victims. And when you don't have all of the pieces in place to protect those rights of the accused, you are no doubt diminishing and you are threatening and challenging the safety of your very victims that help to buttress your cases. And so, yeah, and because of all of that, faith in the entire system begins to erode even more.
Judge, as always, very, very interesting discussion. I hope our audience enjoyed it and learned something. You know, there are so many issues in the law that people don't really spend a lot of time looking at, and this is one of them.
Indeed, and this was really an insightful discussion. I'm so grateful for all of the research and work that you've done to bring us up to speed on this. And I invite our audience to listen, not just here, but to listen to all of our episodes of Next Witness, Please. If you are wondering where you can find us, where you can catch us, and how you can continue to follow us, I want to invite you to look for us on all of the major platforms in which you access your favorite podcasts, starting with perhaps our favorite and our most endeared, that being NPR. You can find us at NPR, at Audible, on Apple, on Amazon, any place where you would find your favorite podcast. Just look for Next Witness, Please. You'll find me and Judge Tom there, working to improve your understanding of the legal system, because we believe you don't trust what you don't understand, and we hope that we've improved your understanding.
And if you have a question or a comment about our podcast, you can always email it to me at Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, Hodson@ohio.edu. And if you also have topics you'd like for us to cover in the future, shoot us an email and we'll add you to the list of growing topics that people have asked us to talk about. Also, we want to indicate to you that Next Witness Please has a Facebook page. So please go there and like us, and you can get all the alerts of our upcoming episodes as we file them and as they're published. We put notices out there so you can keep up to date with everything. That's Next Witness Please on Facebook. Next Witness Please is produced through WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our crackerjack audio. He's an audio engineer. He's also one of our co-producers. Judge Gale and I will be back very soon to give you more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.